the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parents Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
Welcome to the Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia Elcoury.
And I'm Cathy Weston.
Now, tonight's show, we're discussing anxiety in children and overcoming your child's fears and worries. Now, what we want to know is, does your child or teenager display anxious behaviour or seem overly worried about things? Maybe they can't sleep at night, obsess about things, or refuse to go to school. So we're tackling the issue of anxiety in children tonight. And first up, we'll be talking to Dr. Polly Waite, who's a clinical psychologist and research fellow at the University of Reading. And she also works as an honorary clinical psychologist at CAMHS Anxiety and Depression Pathway for Berkshire Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust.
And we'll also be joined later on by a mum whose son has been through the anxiety clinic, which is based in Reading, and we'll talk to her about her experiences. But first, we will be talking to Jo Maher, who's from Vista St Albans, and she is heavily involved in supporting parents and families in the West Harts area. And in a few minutes, Jo will be talking to us about anxiety amongst our school children. And in particular, there's one issue, Jo, that you'd like to raise.
Yes, I can talk a little bit about school refusal. That's mainly in secondary school children.
Is that a common issue at the moment?
It's not common at all. It's a very serious issue, but it is sort of quite new, and I would say growing with some in some areas.
And for those who don't know, I mean, I have to say, when I first heard school refusal, I didn't know what it meant, but school refusal is...
It is a long-term problem. Basically, secondary school children, you need to have an attendance of above 85% legally. Children have to go to school up to the age of 16, as we know. And if this falls behind with unauthorised absences, if parents do not phone in and say why their child's off sick, not attending school, gradually, obviously, everything becomes noted and reported. And then these children will get referred to what we call an attendance improvement officer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the press, you've often seen and heard that parents can be taken to court. This is a very, very real issue. And once the attendance officers are referred, then there's all sorts of action needs to take place with these children.
Okay, yep.
So basically, in a secondary school, there's always somebody assigned in the office to monitor the attendance. So the first thing they would do if a child is not attending, you liaise with the family, you find out from the parents. If it is very obvious that the child has no intention of coming to school, if the parents are struggling, there are support systems and there are services that can help. People like myself, but there's also the police. The police community support officers can actually go round to the house and explain the legal system to the child or young person. They can actually go round to the house and try and persuade the child to go to school. We have behaviour support and what we call rapid response, and those are specialists in teenage behaviour. Again, they could literally go around every morning and try and persuade a young person to go to school. We at Vista have school family workers, so we will work with parents as well as young children and young people. We help the parents with these issues and try and put in strategies most mornings, or liaising with the other services like CAMHS, as we mentioned before, the mental health and GPs, just to see what the actual anxiety, the issue is, why a young person is not going to school. There's lots of counselling now available, but obviously a young person has to be in school to be able to access the counselling. So the reality is that actually once the referral is made to the attendance officer, this starts the clock ticking on the parents being taken to court. It does take 6 months. It's means tested in the end, so the fine could be anything over £1,000 and higher, depending on the parents. Something to note, dads often think that if they are not living in their home and there's a separation in the family, that they are not liable, but they are. Both parents will be fined the same amount, whether they live together or not.
And it seems sort of terribly punitive to insist on the child going to school without understanding the sort of psychological reasons behind them refusing.
There's often, you need to obviously dig deep, but that young person needs to want to be helped. Sometimes if there's autism or Asperger's involved, it is very difficult to get somebody to go to school. That we know as well, the longer you're away, the harder it is to go back. Now, I have to say our secondary schools are fantastic about trying to encourage young people to go back to school. They are very accommodating with reducing timetables and shortening the day to actually encourage young people back into school. They don't want their young people not coming to school. So, you know, there's a lot of help out there, but if a young person really refuses, the only answer is to make this referral to the attendance officer and head off to court.
Which is very serious. I mean, it is a big step. And the problem with all of this is, at what point do they dig down to the causes of why?
We work in what's termed as early intervention, and there's lots of services that work in early intervention. So we try to nip things in the bud as soon as possible. The minute the school is alerted to actually there's an issue here, we might get called in, as I say, the police, to literally start working together as a team. We work with the parents, the family, the wider family, community services to try and get to the root of the problem.
And how often is bullying a cause of it?
I don't know the answer to that, because school refusal could be for any reasons. People immediately think they're being bullied, but it's not always the case. It could be actually mental health issues in the family or at home. They could be literally bereavement or issues like that can cause any anxiety in any young person. Bullying is out there, we know that, but our schools are very, very geared up to dealing with bullying. Cyberbullying is another issue, that when, you know, children on the internet and online get bullied, but the schools still get involved with all of that, and even if it's out in the community. So I wouldn't know what the percentage is that would be the cause of that. But there's very little alternatives to anyone under 16. They have to attend school, and parents have to realise that they are responsible for getting their young person to school, whatever the reason.
And can I say, I mean, if there is a mental disorder or a problem that's stigmatised, is it best to take the child out of the environment, allow them to get treated and discuss it, and then go back into school? Or would you emphasise staying in school no matter what?
We encourage parents to obviously seek help from the GP or CAMHS, which is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. So if it is definitely an issue like that, they need to seek help, obviously, from outside. But they do also have a lot of support in school. There's buddying systems, there's mentoring, people that can help them in school. And the best place for them to be is in school. It may be that they literally just don't like one teacher. They may feel a bit persecuted by a teacher. That is difficult to overcome. Sometimes schools will be accommodating with, okay, well, we'll swap classes or we'll move your timetable. But obviously that's quite difficult for them to do. And some young people have to realise they've got to keep going, and they've got to get in there. They can't just say, I'm not doing geography anymore. They've got to actually follow a curriculum. You know, it's a government directive.
Yeah.
So it is a really big issue. It's difficult to pinpoint because everyone's an individual.
And how easy is it to kind of skip into homeschooling? Just say the issue's too big. It has to be, it'll take time to deal with it. Like, for example, the parent that we'll be talking to at the end of the show, I mean, it took 9 months for her to get the help that she needed, the proper kind of clinical support that she needed. In that case, can you drag your child through school for 9 months of pure misery while you're waiting for the problem to be resolved? Or should you just take them out and homeschool them?
The big, big problem with, again, going back to secondary school children, once you get a very low attendance, you could possibly, if the issue is at the school, maybe you just don't want to go to that school. You could have what we call a managed move. You could try and go to another school. But as we know, the schools in St Albans are bursting at the seams and there's very few places. So also, once a young person has very low attendance, another school possibly may not want to take them on.
Yeah.
So then it becomes you either go to court, you try to find another school yourself, or you homeschool. Now, homeschooling is not great. It's very isolated. And also, that young person will only get the minimum of a curriculum. They literally probably get literacy, numeracy, and maybe a bit of science. You know, we know they're better off in school, and that's why the schools really care, and they actually try extremely hard to keep their young people in school and to keep them educated.
And if there's any parents out there in and around the West Harts area who have got an issue with school refusal or rumbling, what's the, like, rumblings about it, what should they do? Should they go to teachers first?
They need to go to the teacher, the head teacher, or the pastoral, head of pastoral care. They can come to people like us because we have school family workers. So the word there, key word, is family. We work with the families, and we work in between the families and the schools. So we can help them with any issues if there is something wrong at school, with meetings and things like that, and with parenting strategies. Sometimes it's what's going on in the home that then affects the young person going to school, and sometimes the families don't realise that. Mm-hmm. You know, there can be awful mornings, an awful start to the day, and those young people head off in school already stressed to the hilt. And it's very difficult to have a day at school if you've started your day in an awful state. So we help parents. It is very difficult to tell a parent that maybe they need to make some changes for the benefit of their young person. But that's what we're there for.
Fantastic. And it's great to know that resource is there. And obviously, I mean, there must be so many different issues that could cause a child's refusal to go to school. And what we're going to do next is we're going to speak to a clinical psychologist who is an expert in children's anxiety. And anxiety comes in so many shapes and forms, and we want to get a bit deeper into that. So please, Jo, will you hang around with
us?
Yes,
of course.
And let's talk through this issue together. And we'll be talking to Polly Waite, who is the Honorary Clinical Psychologist at CAMHS Anxiety and Depression Pathway for Berkshire Healthcare and NHS Foundation. So stay with us. You're listening to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. Welcome back to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. And thank you to Jo Maher from Vista, who was speaking to us just there on school refusal generally, and obviously in the St Albans area. Now, next up, we're talking to Polly Waite, who's a clinical psychologist in Berkshire Child Anxiety Clinic. Polly, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Now, we've been talking about school refusal, Polly, and the various reasons, but we'd like to kind of get stuck into the subject of anxiety and anxiety disorders. Would you tell us, what do you mean by anxiety disorders, and what's the difference between being a sensitive child and suffering from anxiety?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's some evidence to suggest that some of us are just much more emotionally sensitive than other people, and I'm sure everyone will have experienced that some people are just much more tuned into some people's feelings.
Sorry, Polly, could I ask you just to speak up a little bit, please?
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, I was just saying that there's some evidence to suggest that some of us are just much more emotionally sensitive, and to some degree that is inherited. You know, some of us are just going to be much more hardwired to be more easily startled and more distressed in some situations. But when we're thinking about anxiety, it's really important to stress that anxiety is absolutely normal. You know, we all feel anxious from time to time, and actually that can be really helpful. So if you're anxious about an exam, then that can help you make sure that you prepare for it and you revise and you turn up to the exam. But obviously that's not going to be the case for everybody. So for some people, like the people that we see in our clinic, rather than it actually being helpful, anxiety really gets in the way of them being able to do things. So they have difficulty going to school, like Joe was saying, or doing things when they're at school or other activities. And it can really interfere in family life and lead to them and their families becoming really distressed. And it's in those kind of instances that we're thinking about diagnosing an anxiety disorder. And they affect around 5% of all children, and they're the most common psychological difficulty. So in terms of your question about sensitivity, so not all everybody who's emotionally sensitive is going to have an anxiety disorder, but it might make them more vulnerable in the context of other factors. But not all people with an anxiety disorder will have an emotionally sensitive temperament.
Polly, your clinic, does it deal with children who have just got into a cycle, a vicious cycle with their anxiety? So they're just like every other person's child, but they've just got into a rut and they can't break the cycle. Is that what you help them do?
Yeah, completely. And when we are working with young people with anxiety, we try to really break it down. So, you know, when you talk about cycles, there's three main aspects to anxiety: what we think, what we do, and then what happens in our body. So in anxiety, we often think that something bad is going to happen, and we cope with it by trying to avoid that situation, or we try and do other things to stay safe. And then we also have sort of things going on in our body, like we end up breathing faster, our heart rate speeds up, get butterflies in your stomach as your body gets kind of ready for action. And all of these things, like you're saying, keep each other going, and then they act as a vicious cycle. So, you know, for example, if a child worries that they might not do their homework right, which is a, you know, completely normal worry that, you know, other children will have from time to time. But, you know, for some children where they get really worried about it, really worried they're going to get a detention, other children will think they're stupid, then they might do lots of things to try to avoid that. So they might make sure they've written their homework down, they've checked with their friends, they get their parents to help, check it over. And the sort of feelings of tension and tummy aches might give them even more evidence that something bad's going to happen. So whilst that ensures that they might have done the homework correctly, it kind of is a problem because it keeps them believing that getting the homework wrong would be a complete disaster, and then believing that they can only cope if other people step in and help, and that they need to do all of those things to stay safe. And then it means that they lack confidence in their own ability to deal with the situation, and all of that really keeps the problem going. So when we're working with children to try and break that cycle, or when as a parent you're working with your child to try and break it, then what we really want to try and do is help them to develop a much less anxious, more realistic point of view, and enable them, the child, to feel much more confident, to have a go at doing things rather than being put off because they're anxious. So, I mean, all of that is based on cognitive behaviour therapy, which is simplified to CBT, which is based on the idea that by changing how you think and what you do, that has an impact on how you feel. And we know that the evidence shows that CBT is the most effective treatment for anxiety in children, but also in adults too.
And Polly, to sort of break that down, maybe parents are listening and think, oh, that sounds scary, cognitive behavioural therapy. In our hands here, we've got the book that produced by the psychologists in your clinic, Overcoming Your Child's Fears and Worries.
Yeah.
And it's such a fantastic little practical guide.
It's a handbook, isn't
it? It's a handbook.
Yeah, it is. It's a really great book. So that's written by Kathy Creswell and Lucy Willits. And in fact, we use it in our clinic with parents really successfully. We've just completed a large treatment trial using that book and getting parents to work with their child. And in fact, we haven't even had the child in the therapy session, so parents put it into practice on their own with really good results. So for actually some people, for some families, just parents getting hold of that book will be enough. But then there are other families where actually they might need a bit more than that.
Because the thing that, is this true to say that, you know, with young children, say under 10, you know, if you can nip things in the bud, say, in terms, I find your book very useful because it gave you the language to have the conversation about the thing they were anxious about.
Yeah.
And the sort of conversation starters and the way of the alternative, the way to, the helpful way to question them, help them look for evidence and alternatives to what they're thinking. But is it true to say that if we try and nip it in the bud early, that's the best strategy any parent can have?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely because, you know, I mean, even if you end up going on to have treatment, I think for parents to really understand how anxiety works, you know, the sort of ideas behind what we do in treatment, and then as a first step have a go at working with your child to help manage their anxiety, then, you know, that's got to be really great. And, you know, and then if it's the case that they need further help down the line, at least they have a good sense of what are the things that they can do as parents, what are the helpful things that they can do to support their child, and what are the things that they might be doing that might be inadvertently reinforcing it, although they're done with the best of intentions.
Well, that's exactly, I mean, what you're saying. I mean, I think everybody's touched by anxiety to a greater or lesser degree in their children, and being able to understand it and be equipped with the right open kind of questions to stop exacerbating the situation is kind of what every parent would want and kind of needs in lots of ways. Like, I think this is a great handbook, even if you don't really detect that your child does have anxieties or issues, just to kind of be aware of complications and potential issues.
Yeah, completely, because I think one of the big challenges as a parent is basically to realise that children go through different phases where fears are really common, and then there are particular fears that kick in at particular ages. So, you know, when you've got a sort of 6 to 9 month baby, then often they're really scared of strangers, and that's absolutely normal. And in fact, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, it's really clever because it keeps the baby with their parents and out of harm's way. And then later on, as children get more mobile and they sort of get to 2 years old, then, you know, as parents who have children that they have to drop off at nursery will know, separation anxiety really peaks, and that can be a real challenge to manage that. And then other anxieties kick in as children get older. So, you know, to know that that's normal, but to enable you to have strategies so that they don't develop into something more problematic, I think is really, really useful.
Great. And Polly, can we just ask you, how does treatment differ for different age groups and in length of time?
Yeah, well, in some ways it doesn't necessarily differ that much. I mean, we know that CBT is effective for the most young people. So around sort of 55 to 60% of young people no longer have their anxiety disorder diagnosis at the end of treatment. And what is really great is that typically things continue to improve. So because it's about teaching lots of strategies and skills that actually people then are encouraged to keep going with, then actually we find that those gains are maintained, you know, years after finishing treatment. Now, in terms of age, it doesn't necessarily differ that greatly, but the key thing is obviously if you're working with children from different age groups, you want to make sure that the materials, you know, and the language and the content of the sessions is appropriate for that person's developmental level. We do see some differences in terms of age. So with teenagers, anxiety disorders do tend to be a bit more severe, and that might be because it's been around for longer, untreated. And they do tend to be maybe a little bit more depressed than you'd see with younger children. So with our sort of 7 to 12-year-old age groups, depression that would meet a kind of clinical criteria for depression is quite unusual. But with our teenagers, it's much more common. And teenagers also are more likely to have issues around behaviour. So it's obviously important to take all of those other things into consideration.
Polly, does anxiety always slip into depression?
No, not necessarily. I mean, what we tend to find is with anxiety disorders, it's very common to have more than one of them. So it, sort of 40 to 60% of children who have one anxiety disorder will have another one too. So they might have separation anxiety, and there might be a specific phobia as well, or they might be a general worrier and meet a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder. So they are more likely to experience depression, but they certainly, so I think the rate is sort of they're 4 times more likely to get depression, but there's certainly not a direct link. There are particular types of anxiety that are more commonly seen with depression, so things like social phobia. And that makes sense because if you're not able to do things that your peers are doing, you're not, you know, able to do activities, and you know, maybe there are issues about
it's easily exacerbated, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. So you can totally understand how that happens. So more often than not, we tend to see that somebody has an anxiety disorder, and then as a consequence of the impact of that anxiety, they are then depressed, or they just have a sort of persistent low mood that doesn't quite meet the level for depression, but generally they just feel more down day to day than other youngsters of their age might feel, and again, that's completely understandable.
And Polly, we've spoken a lot tonight about a sort of a local issue that's emerging of school refusal, quite a few cases here. And we've been talking to Joe Maher from an organisation locally about that. Have you got anything? I know there's a chapter in your book on school refusal. Could you just talk a little bit about that? Is it, if it's a, you know, why it sort of merited a whole chapter?
Yeah, well, we see a lot of young people where there are issues around school. And I think it's understandable that children are anxious when it comes to school, because school involves so many different challenges. So, you know, it's about being apart from your parents or your family. And then you have to do so many demanding things like, you know, answering questions in front of lots of other people, taking tests, working with other children, mixing with your peers. You know, invariably there'll be times when you have difficult interactions. And just, you know, things like getting undressed in PE for some people, you know, particularly teenage girls can
be really anxiety. We've all got horror stories about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So I think actually it's really common. And like Joe was saying, you know, there can be a lot of different reasons why somebody's struggling with school. So I guess it comes back to what we would do anyway in CBT, which is about trying to find out what the young person's scared of. So questions like, you know, what worries you about going to school, and in your worst nightmare, what would you worry about happening, can be helpful to try to figure out exactly what's going on. And, you know, some children, I think, worry that if they tell their parents, then their parents are going to wade in and make the problem worse. So as a parent, I think it's really important to establish trust with your child and stress that if you're going to discuss it, you know, you're doing it because you want to come up with a plan together, and it's not that you're about to sort of leap in and take any action without the young person agreeing to it. And then in terms of, I guess, what we would do in the clinic is, it comes back to one of the most important parts of CBT, which is really about the child sort of investigating and testing out how things work by exposing themselves to the things that they're scared of, but doing it in a very gradual way, because often children end up in a sort of yo-yoing where they're in the anxious situation and then they become really distressed and then they avoid it. So what we find effective is actually doing it step by step, so starting with things that are sort of 2 or 3 out of 10 scary before moving up to things and working in that way. And I think that's a pattern that schools are very good at doing. And I think they're, you know, from what we've found in working with schools can often be very tuned into the idea of needing to do it gradually. And, you know, involving school and the education welfare services can be really critical in getting children back into school, but doing it in a kind of step-by-step way.
Okay, Polly, I wanted to ask you, is there a link between anxiety and self-esteem?
Yeah, that's a tricky one, but certainly some children with anxiety are likely to have low self-esteem, and we see that. And in some cases, a bit like when we were talking about low mood, it's likely to be related to their anxiety. So if someone's not able to do the same things as their peer group, then it would be understandable that they might feel bad about themselves. But there's also likely to be some children who have low self-esteem, maybe as a result of early experiences in their life, and then they have sort of negative beliefs about themselves that they're not good enough, which makes them feel more anxious, and then they're more likely to avoid situations where they feel that other people might find out. I mean, certainly there's some evidence that children and adults with psychological difficulties have greater levels of low self-esteem, but we don't really know that much about it, and that's partly because there are disagreements about how to define low self-esteem, and also it's not a diagnosis, so as a result of that, it gets overlooked in research. But I suppose when we're thinking about treatment, we would still be recommending dealing with anxiety using the same kind of treatment approaches, whether or not self-esteem is an issue.
Now, Polly, we've got a question from a listener here. I hope that's okay. This lady has a 9-year-old son who has very generalised anxiety worry. So he'll fret if he can't find his school bag. You know, there's sort of minor anxieties which seem to put him in a very sort of anxious state.
Yeah.
Is that indicative of sort of the beginnings of an anxiety state, or is that something that needs to be explored further? She wants to know.
It's difficult to know, but I think, you know, that kind of worry is really common amongst children. So I suppose regardless of whether it's an emerging anxiety disorder, it would be about trying to tackle it in the same kind of way. So if we were working with somebody with those kind of worries, the first thing we would be trying to figure out is, what are they worried about? You know, is it something like, are they worried about, you know, not turning up to school with their homework and getting into trouble, and exactly what their fear is about? And then we'd be starting to think about trying to reevaluate their thought and think about other points of view, you know, so asking questions like, are there ever times when you have forgotten your homework and what happened, and, you know, coming up with ideas. Well, I mean, one of the things we do with children is we do problem solving, because there will be some times where, you know, anxiety is about real life problems like forgetting homework. So it's not always about challenging their thoughts. It might be about coming up with lots of different solutions. So problem solving can be helpful to think of lots of different ideas how you can deal with it and work out the pros and cons and pick the best one. Because one of the things that we find is that parents often inadvertently end up reinforcing the problem by reassuring their child or stepping in and trying to help them out. And although they're doing that with the best of intentions, because nobody likes to see their child distressed, by actually sort of stepping in and taking over can make things more difficult and keep the problem going. So actually for the child to come and come up with solutions themselves and be sort of guided to think of different ideas as to what they could do can help. And then it's about parents sort of stepping back and not necessarily moving in to solve the problem, but encouraging the child to come up with ways of solving it.
And I think the message of your book, Polly, of overcoming your child's fears and worries, is that you've got to explore the anxiety in the right way with a structured conversation that you've suggested, rather than saying, don't be silly, or what are you worrying about? Or there is a methodology that parents can adopt.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, and sometimes you will know what your child's worried about, but sometimes they might surprise you. So it's about sort of trying to be curious and sort of imagining, even if you think you know what they're worrying about, trying to sort of pretend you don't and be completely neutral so that you give them the space to be able to say what it is. And by asking them the questions, you know, we all learn better when we kind of figure things out for ourselves rather than somebody explaining it to us. And it's exactly that same principle. But it's also about parents trying to make sure that they're reinforcing the right thing. So really giving their child lots of praise and attention when they're brave and they're managing things for themselves and they're being independent. And then when their children are more anxious, it's about just making sure that there's not excessive amounts of reassurance or comforting, but actually they're really reinforcing their children being brave.
Great, Polly. Thank you so much. Can I ask, is the book available generally? Can we get it on Amazon or in bookshops?
Yeah, it's part of a series, actually. So there are books to cover all sorts of different difficulties. A lot of them are with adults, so actually it's very readily available.
Great stuff. So you can just
Overcoming Your Child's Fears and Worries, a guide for parents using cognitive behavioural techniques, and it's by Kathy Creswell and Lucy Willits.
That's great. Polly, thank you so much for joining us this evening and for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
All the best.
Bye.
Bye.
Your friend of the airwaves, Radio Verulam.
Thanks for joining us again on The Parent Show. Tonight's show is all about children and anxiety. Now, first up, we spoke to Jo Marr from VISTA, a local organisation, on school refusal. Then we spoke to Polly Waite, a clinical psychologist at the University of Reading. And now we'd like to speak to a mum who went through a training course at the Berkshire Child Anxiety Clinic. And Karen is on the line now. Karen, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Now, Karen, can you tell us a little bit about what it is you experienced and why your son was referred to the clinic?
My son, about a year ago now, suffered a panic attack which created great anxiety for him, which he felt he couldn't. He had a choking incident in a restaurant, which led to him believing that he would choke whenever he ate anything. So, in fact, he wouldn't eat, which obviously was very distressing. I guess, though, from listening to everybody talking earlier, my son was always quite a worrier, but in this particular incident, he just got worse and worse. His anxiety just was so intense that he, you know, obviously you can't have a child that won't eat. So, and I knew it wasn't something where you would tell him just, you know, you'll get over it, you know, pull yourself together. It wasn't like that at all. He was exceedingly upset, emotional, and so I had to do something. So
absolutely.
I actually went to my doctor.
And did the doctor refer you to the clinic?
No, because obviously to start off with, he tried to reassure Jensen. He explained all what would happen, that he actually wouldn't choke, that the body's natural mechanism would come in, but Jensen still continued to worry. He was exceedingly anxious, couldn't get him to eat, in fact, so we had to, for quite a while, he would only have things with soup, he would only have anything where he had lots to drink so he could help him swallow, In fact, he just analysed the whole technique of swallowing so much so that it just caused him to choke even more. So it re-emphasised to him the problem that he had.
That must have been terrifying for you as a mother to have to kind of be so powerless, I suppose, in getting him to overcome that.
Well, it was, because you... it's not something that you hear people talking about. And in the end, I did go back to my doctor, who then suggested that that we should go to an anxiety clinic. But with talking to all different friends, it was actually, you know, it was associated with a lot of stigma. And I was advised, even from, you know, from close people to me, that I shouldn't go through it, that, you know, he would grow out of it. And but I just felt that this was something that he would not grow out of, and that it was something that was just getting worse. And I desperately needed help, and I just didn't know where to go. So to me, when I had it first explained to me, it seemed very logical that it was the obvious place I should go. What I didn't realise is that you'd have to wait so long, because obviously the particular programme that I was on, there's a lot of people waiting to go on to it, and they have to make sure that when you do go through the treatment that you're going to benefit from it. So, you know, there's a lot of questions, there's a lot of questionnaires you have to complete, speak to different people before you get accepted onto the programme. And I just feel very fortunate that I was accepted, and we have been through it now and out the other side, and we have tools now to that will last my son for his entire life. Because I think, as Polly mentioned, that anybody with anxieties, my son has got over one anxiety and he has other anxieties, and so we follow the program and the exercises and steps that are within the book to help get over the next anxiety, which, you know, is all around. It could be anything from Jensen having water on his head to him concentrating on his heartbeat and he thinks his heart's going to stop.
And they're all kind of logically interconnected, his anxieties,
yes.
You know, and from what Polly was saying, there are different anxieties come out in different phases, and his seems to be quite biological. It's the functions of the body, and it, I, you know.
And I think, it's because he over-analyzes it. But obviously someone who is anxious, that is what they do. They think about it. They can't not stop thinking about it, as somebody who, you know, may experience choking themselves would just get over it and they wouldn't think any more about it. But with his makeup, he just continually thought about it, and just to him, it was, in his own words, he actually said that for a time he didn't think life was worth living. And for a child of 11 to say that is exceedingly disturbing.
Yeah, I know, it's every parent's worst nightmare.
Karen, what would you say is the most effective piece, you know, information in the book? What do you use regularly with him? Which technique, or what is it that's your sort of staple?
Well, I mean, there's a whole host of techniques in the book that you can use, but I think it is basically, instead of trying to feel that you need to fix this entire anxiety, is to take everything in the steps that was mentioned earlier by Polly, that everything is broken down. So in fact, that you do see that by doing a little step and doing a little bit of encouragement and agreeing together what it is that we're going to do to achieve something, so that, you know, we can move to the next step, that we can also get a positive outcome, that my son will see that actually what he feared is actually not as bad as he thought. I believe, though, that one of the great things about this particular program is that it actually helps the parent also, because what you don't realise is that you actually make the anxiety worse by trying to, in some ways, you try to avoid the very things that they should be facing.
Right.
And it makes you realise that, you know, you're part of the cycle, and you need to break out of that.
And that's really interesting. And not what I would have expected either. You know, your intuition is if anything's caused, you just avoid, stay away from it.
Well, that's right. And I think, though, then obviously that just reinforces to the child that that is, you know, it just makes them fear it even more. Whereas the idea is to actually encourage them in a very small way that they should
face their fears.
Well, that's right. It's exactly what they say, that they're going to face their fear. And in the book, it gives you various suggestions, and you can use rewards to help start facing what it is that they most fear. And also then they can see that, you know, what is the worst thing that can happen? And actually, it's not as bad as they actually thought. And the more times that they experience a positive from whatever it is that they worry about, the more confident they get to move on to the next step. And in fact, although we did start off with rewards, which in my case, it was, you know, he's a boy, he likes comics, so whenever he did a particular step, he got a comic. In the end, I didn't need to give him a comic because he felt good about going to the next step.
And another thing I wanted to ask you, Karen, is did you do the training course together, yourself and your son?
No, we went initially where we were assessed together, and then it was very much I would go every week, and I would be given various tasks to complete in the week, and then I would report back. And I was fortunate because I did actually see Cathy Creswell, who is one of the co-authors of the book that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And we would go over how the week had been, what we had done, and new things that I needed to do for the next week, and what had got worse, what had got better, you know, because every child is different and certain techniques will work better with some than others.
Karen, how is he doing now?
Well, it's, as I say, it's nearly a year later, and we now have light at the end of the tunnel, and he does eat, although we do have moments, in fact recently, where he's not eating so well because he's had a cold, so it's making him feel that he's going to choke again. But whereas a year ago I was totally didn't know what to do and felt I had nowhere to turn, I now don't feel that way. I feel very positive that this is just a little glitch and we'll get over it, and I can follow the steps of the book, and through talking with Jensen and helping him move on, we'll get over this one.
That's fantastic. It's great to hear how empowered you and your son have been through the process. And the thing that, correct me if I'm wrong, the thing I'm hearing from you most is that you trust your intuition and kind of ignore the stigma that might be pushed onto your, like, ignore other people if your gut's telling you to reach out and get help.
No, definitely. I mean, this is one of the best things I ever did, and as I say, we now have tools going forward that will help my son, whereas so many people suffer because they're not offered this help. So I was very fortunate to be put on this program and have a doctor that also put me forward, because it's it takes quite a while to get there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Karen, and for sharing your story.
Not at all. Thank you.
All the very best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good evening.
Welcome back to The Parent Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. And the ladies at Boucherelle will be joining us tonight, right after the show. So stay tuned to The Parent Show for the next 7 minutes, and then you'll get to brush up your French and find out what's going on locally in the Francophile community. Is that the right word? That's it. Now it's coming towards the end.
Bonsoir.
Hey, bonsoir.
That's not to mean any French, because I can't say anymore.
I'm completely out of my depth already. I've got Irish or German. That's it.
Can't do either of those.
Yeah,
let's stick with English, shall we? We might be able to understand each other.
If my accent accounts for English. But it counts as being English. How are you, Claire?
I'm all right, thank you. Yeah. How are you?
Frozen solid.
Yeah, but you didn't injure yourself doing any sledging accidents or anything like that?
No, not at all. Not at all. No, thank God.
I haven't heard of many. There is a little boy in the paper, but I don't know that there's been that many, so fingers crossed.
People
have had some safe fun in the snow.
I've heard some some great spots have kind of come out of the woodwork of places to go sledging through
this
bit of snow. Have you heard of what's it called, Batchwood?
Oh, the golf course, Batchford Golf Course is fantastic.
And so, has somebody ever heard you talk about the Bowl or something like that?
The Bowl? No, that's a new one to me.
It's in Batchford. Apparently there's one little part of it that is obviously very slippy and round, I'm assuming.
That sounds about right, doesn't it? Oh, fantastic. Yeah, but you've got to get to Batchford, haven't you? So you've got to be within walking distance to be able to get there, but the slopes are meant to be fantastic, so I've heard. I'm not close enough on a snow day to get there. I suppose you're not either.
Not really, and we kind of did a venture across town and went to Verulamium Park, but it took us the whole day.
Yeah.
The whole day there.
And you're cold and wet. You forget that when you set out, don't you?
Oh,
you're
absolutely.
You're going to be so cold when you're finished.
Absolutely. I tell you, if I could have got a taxi back.
But it came at the weekend, so it was fab.
Indeed.
It was fab.
Indeed. So what's going on?
Well, this weekend, we've obviously got our Residents' First weekend, which is a weekend that's set up by, it's been going for 11 years apparently, it's set up by St Albans District Council, and it's really to encourage residents to make use of whatever we've got here, all the fun stuff that we've got, all the attractions, not all the attractions, but some of the attractions that usually charge to go in are allowing people to come in for free, which is great to give them a taster of what they can do. And there is a brilliant website. The website is stalbans.gov.uk/residents-first. And if you go on there and you keep up to date, you can see all the vouchers, the competitions, the offers, the free places that you can go in, all sorts of things. And I thought I'd just go through, I'd just run through one or two that particularly stood out as children friendly, really, this weekend. So Butterfly World, who now actually closed for the season, they open again on the 25th of March. They're opening on Sunday. You can basically see what they've got planned for the next season. They'll talk you through it. There are no butterflies, but it is free to get in. So you can go to the Nectar House Cafe and have a cup of tea, free car parking, and go and see the Leaf Cutter Ant exhibition, because I went to see them. They are amazing.
Are they?
They are leaf these cutter little ants. Tiny ants are carrying these massive great leaves, compared to their size, it is very, very interesting. The courtroom trials, I've told you about before on this show, I think they're fantastic. The courtroom, which is in the Old Town Hall downstairs, they have tours where you can go and see the cells where they... The courtroom, which isn't normally open to the public. Wow. So it's quite an interesting place to go in with children. Another one which is interesting, the Museum of St Albans, you know, we're obviously trying to move the museum to the town hall. They are inviting people, which I think is quite brave, to go in with post-it notes and write what they hate and what they like about the museum, the things that they enjoy. So I think they're trying to get some really good feedback, some honest feedback, so you can go in with and just stick on your post-it note.
That's a
I love
great
this,
idea.
Or I hate this.
Very so democratic.
It is, isn't it? I thought that was a really good one. So that's a great one for children.
Hang on just a second. Here she's trying to flick over the page.
Oh, there's Radio Verulam, of course. Yeah, the studios are open to visit as well, aren't they?
That's it.
They are limited, only 6 people at a time. Yeah. So you will have to be patient, and there are steps. Or stairs, steep stairs. So be aware of that when you come in. But do come and visit the studios, because see where we work from.
Indeed.
It's great.
Indeed. Our expansive studios.
Yes, yes. St Albans Cathedral. Now, they are doing loads of things over the weekend. On Saturday and Sunday, they've got tower tours. Now, you need a voucher for these. And to get a voucher, you need to go to the town hall. And on the Saturday or Sunday that you go, and once you've got your voucher, you can go up and they'll book you in a time, and you can go up and climb the tower. Minimum age is 11, and restrictions do apply, and there are only 12 people per tour, so that might be quite limited, so get your voucher. But during Saturday at the cathedral, they've got a family fun trail as well, so there are lots of things. They do lots of these trails, sort of treasure trails around the cathedral, so you can learn a bit more about them, that's really... really family friendly, that one. What else did I highlight? There's lots of things. Talking Newspapers, which is next door to us.
Yes,
they're
it
open
is, it
as
is.
Well.
Yep, right in the centre of town.
St Albans South Signal Box, which is on Richmond Road.
I've
Richmond
heard so
Road.
Many great things about that.
Now, I think they open every fourth Sunday, don't they? I believe.
Right.
But they're opening Saturday 10 till 4, Sunday 10 till 4. And you can go for any train enthusiast, young or old, you know, granddad and grandson, great day out for them.
Yeah,
pop down there. And then there are lots and lots of offers, different things, different businesses that are taking part in it. And then the leisure centres are offering some good deals. You can use, if you are so inclined, free use of the athletics track down at Abbey View. If the snow is cleared
enough.
Well,
I was just about to say, or the ice rink as it's known at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. 2-for-1 on all rounds of golf at Batchwood. Harpenden Sports Centre are offering half-price badminton and tennis and free weekend passes for the gym and fitness classes and 50% off joining fee. Harpenden Swim Centres are offering residents free weekend swim and health suite passes, which is quite a good deal.
That's very good.
Great for this time of year. Soft play at London Coney is £2 for one child, and Westminster Lodge have got loads and loads of come and try sessions. So
fantastic.
Lots going on.
Give us the website.
It's stalbans.gov.uk/residents-first.
Great stuff, Claire. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
And thanks to all our guests this evening for making it such an interesting and insightful show. Anything you want to know about anxiety, definitely listen back to the podcast. It'll be available within a week. Next week, we'll be talking to none other than Steve Biddulph himself.